to The Cooler Ring, a podcast for manufacturing marketers brought to you by Cooler Partners. My name is Jeff White, and joining me today is Carmen Perry. Carmen, how are you doing, sir?
Look, thrilled to be joining you for yet another episode of The Cooler Ring. Glad to be here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And I'm excited to delve into today's topic because I think it's one that more and more marketers are finding is being kind of foisted on them, I guess you could say, in a lot of ways. It's something that more and more people are dealing with, and I think our guest has a unique perspective.
Yeah. It's easy to talk about the way the world of marketing changes and things of that sort through the lens of tactics or technology advancements or what have you, but this is more about how the role is changing from an expectations perspective and almost a skill set or nuanced perspective in some way. I don't want to give it all away. I think it's going to be an interesting chat.
Yeah, no, me as well. So joining us today is Phil Harris. Phil is the director of marketing at Polo. Welcome to The Cooler Ring, Phil.
Thank you, guys. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Phil, thank you for joining us. And I wonder, can you maybe start by letting us know a little bit about Polo? What do y'all do over at Polo?
Yeah, so Polo is a privately held heat treating company. We call it thermal processing too, a little marketing lingo there. But heat treating is at the core of what we do. We do some value-added services as well. But essentially, people that make metal parts, manufacturers out there, ship their parts to us. We heat them up and cool them down in a specific way to make them stronger, softer, perform better in the field, and we ship them back. And so we're part of the supply chain that, unless you've watched Forged in Fire or something like that, you might not be aware even exists. But it's a little bit more complicated than that. We have 5 locations in the U.S. And 1 down in Mexico, about 500 employees. We've been around since 1943.
Interesting call it thermal treatment or what have you. I noticed as I was going through the website, there were all these words that seemed like they weren't words that you had maybe made up, like nitriding and things like that. And I was like, no, they're actually words. And they are processes that I just didn't understand. I do know about heat treating, but I didn't know about a lot of those.
And to be fair, I like the way Phil kind of explained it because, frankly, it took a fairly complicated thing and simplified it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Not a lot of marketers can land on that quite that way. Phil, when we chatted about doing this show, I guess the thing that really stood out is that you seem to be encountering, or part of just what you've seen in your career, and just so I'm clear, how long have you been with Polo?
About 9.5 years at this point.
Yeah, so it's that's a good run, and so you've seen a lot of change and evolution in that, and we're talking about how part of that change has been kind of the blurring of the lines, if you will, between marketing and sales and kind of all of what that means. So I don't want to put too many words in your mouth, so maybe I'll stop and ask you, what does it mean? Like, when you talk about the blurring of lines between marketing and sales, or that kind of marketing is facing new sales driven pressures, kind of, let's unpack that a bit. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so we call it the gray area. So we put a flag in the ground and said, like, when we're in these discussions, that's where we know where we are. So so nobody gets frustrated one side or the other. And all this being said, I get along great with our sales team. It wouldn't be possible if I didn't. So I think what's happened in my view is salespeople have more and more stuff that they're trying to do. They get dragged into the operations side of things. And so there's a string pulling both ends. More time prospecting, more time qualifying, more time on the phone, on the road, but then also trying to walk jobs all the way, to the bank, so to speak. And I think part of what's happened is that there's time pressure. And so they want the leads to be better, so they have to spend less time up front, which, I want the leads to be as good as they can be too. And I think the other thing is, the other force at play here is revenue is important to everybody. And as marketers, I think we all want to be judged on revenue. We can, because that's what we're after too. And so, it's really a team effort, but where the handoff happens, I think, is where this trouble comes up.
And is it just that you're sort of seeing that that marker of when you would traditionally have handed over a lead is far later than you were used to?
Yeah, I think the desire is that, you know, that the leads be, you know, not just qualified prospects, but ready to buy, you know, with budget. And I think, you know, maybe there's this missing role, and that's, you know, essentially what like an SDR type role would be that does that pre-qualification. But at least the way that we run things, you know, we're a pretty lean team. And so a lot of that stuff we try to do through technology. You know, there's always one more thing you can add to a form on a website to better qualify those leads, right? So anyway, I think that's the tension in a nutshell.
And I just I don't want to get too far from the gray area point. You folks, actually, when you know you're having a conversation that's in that gray area, you name it so that people have basically are more successful in navigating that dialogue.
Yeah, I think we you know, some self reflection and talking to each other about, you know, being frustrated. We realize that's it. It's at the root of it. It's is it your job or is it mine? And it doesn't matter, but if it is my job, I really want to know and I want to own it. And I think that's, you know, the other big thing that comes up here is, you know, degree of ownership of, you know, which part of the process, because like I hate failing at stuff. And so if I'm going to own a part of it, I really want to be good at it and I want control of it. I mean, that's just a personal part of me.
Yeah, but that's a great tip, though, Phil. I just don't want to just gloss over just that, because it opens the door to real dialogue then. Yeah. And how many times have I seen marketing and sales organizations having that conversation without that clarity? And it kind of boils frustration, you know? You can just see it happening in the room. So that's really cool advice. I wonder, when we talk about how, you know, there's a desire for the leads to be nurtured more before they're handed over to sales, and maybe that would have been a role for an SDR. I also think that's an important point because, you know, a lot of this kind of playbook has been written, and we beat this drum a lot, by SaaS marketers and SaaS go-to-market teams, and they all, you know, for the most part, have inside sales organizations with SDRs in that role that you mentioned. But that is not often the world of manufacturers. So that kind of lack of the SDR role really does play into this tension, doesn't it?
I think so. And I think it's amplified by the voices, the sales voices that you see on social media, because a lot of this, you know, content on LinkedIn is SaaS sales and marketing driven, and it's reliant on this infrastructure that, as you mentioned, doesn't exist in small to medium sized businesses.
Was there an inflection point that you remember in your near decade at Paulo where it kind of started to shift and you were getting more pushback on, you know, we need additional detail, these people need to be better qualified? Like, was there a point that you noticed, and can you align that with anything?
I can. So a couple website revisions ago and a couple CRMs ago and all of that. But I can remember sitting in a room and looking through a huge list of marketing qualified leads that younger me had kind of pushed over to the sales team through some assignment rules with a little bit of lead scoring and thought I was doing a pretty good job. And the feedback that we got was just that they were junk. And I'm sure some of them weren't. I'm sure a lot of them were. But you know, just because somebody fills out a form for a white paper or, you know, signs up to do a webinar or whatever it might be, doesn't mean that they're ready to talk to a salesperson. And so I remember kind of having this knockdown, drag out conversation. And I said, if we're going to move the goalposts, so to speak, you know, if you're going to move my cheese, then let's just put it somewhere that we're really happy with, that you guys are really happy with. And what I suggested was that we move this barrier way far, like a form that says, I want to talk to a salesperson, or I want a quote. Like, if that's not good enough, then then I'm, you know, there's no more I can do than that, right? And we said, until they get to that point, sales isn't going to see them. They're not going to show up in the CRM. They're just going to live in my part of it. And so I think that was like kind of the seismic change. And I said, hey, if we get to the point where you don't have enough leads, I can turn the faucet back on. They're not going to be, you know, you don't think they're the best leads, but that's where we ended up. And I think, so that's probably the most pivotal moment that I can remember.
Did that, you know, have you refined how you're going about that enough now that it's kind of like, did that result in fewer leads going to sales and it's taken a while to kind of build that back up? Or is it kind of like, no, now we know what our respective jobs are and we're just going to kind of keep pushing forward, or has it like iterated and continued to change?
I'll say that it's iterated and changed, but that baseline is still true. So I still feel like I've got the really high barrier to pushing those leads over to sales. I'll say the quality is phenomenal. The win rate on them is great. And they're happy to see them. Where I try to push the boundaries is with, you know, new campaigns or new techniques and say, why don't you guys take a look at these a little bit early? And if they're not okay, then we'll scale them back and play by the normal rules. But I try to test those boundaries occasionally, just to make sure. And luckily we've been in a great cycle here where, you know, there more leads is always better, but, things have been good.
There can sometimes be a weird kind of an unexpected positive upside when you kind of get a little bit more pointed in your calls to action. When you say, like, do you want to talk to a salesperson? Are you looking to speak to one of our experts to buy now? A lot of people, I think, marketers sometimes fall into this trap of thinking that they have to try to trick people into buying from them. But, you know, an awful lot of manufacturers find that, you know, they make stuff that people need. And it's not necessarily, sales isn't necessarily a bad word. I wonder if you, what was your experience when you kind of started making those adjustments and, like, did you notice that the lead flow kind of leaned into those kind of more bottom of funnel, honest almost calls to action, if you will?
I think so. I don't necessarily have the data to support that, but I think gut feel wise, I think yes. But heat treating is not optional. You either need it or you don't. So it's usually on the print. So if you're making the part, you got to buy it from somebody or do it yourself. So we're not going to convince somebody to start heat treating something that wasn't in most cases. It's just a choice of whether they're buying it from us or buying it from one of our competitors. And so making that as quick and easy as possible, and really kind of leaning into that customer experience a little bit, to the extent that we as manufacturers can, because we still need more information to heat treat your parts than to check out on Amazon.
It is an interesting point, the idea of trying to reduce friction, like in something like this, where you obviously need a lot of detail in order to get it right.
Have you found that as a result of trying to get more bottom of funnel ready leads to the sales team, is it all still being kind of done on a single conversion, or are there other multiple touches that you're trying to work on? Are you still working on bringing in more top of funnel or just kind of problem aware leads that you're then working up to a point where you hand them over?
Yeah. So that's a big question. I'll try to make a small answer. I'm still trying to fill up the top of the funnel. Like there's a part of me that believes in content above almost everything else. The cheapskate in me loves that, especially about heat treating, it's evergreen. Heat treating hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot in a very long time, you know, the science behind it. So if we can answer those questions and be a resource for people, I do believe, in that line of thinking. The thing that we've seen success with that, it sounds old and boring is a newsletter. And so driving that kind of, you know, curiosity and those high level top of funnel people and getting them to sign up for the newsletter and then staying in their inbox. If you buy heat treating, it's a matter of time before you need a new heat treater or you have a new project that your current heat treater can't handle. And so being there when the need happens is super important to us. And so being in their inbox, and we've managed to keep the open rates really high and the click-through rates really high. And we put really aggressive call to actions in every single one of those, and they convert. So it's kind of old school, but it's working.
That makes sense to me. You know, people aren't going to be in market. It's the old B2B tail as old as time. Only 5% or so of a target account list is in market at any given time. So you have to stay in front of them. But, and you say the calls to action are pretty aggressive in that newsletter. Are the is there a type of content in that newsletter that you found that, or that at least your hunch is kind of is what's working and what's keeping the open rates up?
It's fresh. I think that's the big one. So we're then responsible for having enough fresh content to populate the newsletter. And so that kind of prescribes our content calendar to an extent. We recycle stuff, some of the greatest hits and all that. But keeping it fresh, trying to rotate through industries, making sure that it's not, there's something in there for everybody to some extent, right? We serve a lot of end markets. So aerospace, automotive, agriculture, you could pretty much name the whole list. And we haven't segmented the newsletter terribly by industry. I've found segmentation by industry to be pretty unreliable and a pretty big data mess. So rather than do that, we try to just put something in there that'll be relevant, whether it's news about us, people stuff always goes over well, or whether it's the next latest greatest article about a heat trading term that sounds like we made it up.
don't tell them that. but I think, though, a lot of our listeners can take some lessons from that, because, I believe you're a team of one in your organization.
Correct.
Many of the marketers that we've interviewed on the show and that listen to the show are in a similar situation. You segment your email newsletter into 15 different sub industries and categories, and all of a sudden you need to write 15 articles instead of one that is going to apply across all of these different places. Maybe you need to get better at creating omni content that functions for just about anybody who's going to be listening. At least, there's going to be something for everyone in each issue, because otherwise you're not going to be able to keep up.
Yeah, and I think we've fallen into that trap before and realized it and backtracked, and so that's definitely a good lesson learned. I think while we're on the topic, we noticed that the open rates were so good that we asked ourselves if we should double down, right? I've always approached it with I get so many newsletters, I read so few of them. I had a lot of skepticism coming into it, and so we tried it, and we added a quarterly roundup of kind of all the best articles from the quarter. And that's how we increased frequency just a little bit. And again, saw open rates stay nice and high. So, kind of again, dipping the toe in the water, on a trial basis, but not trying to burn the bridge of trust that we get when we get somebody's email.
Another great tip, Phil, because I think as marketers, we maybe tend to be a little bit more cynical about the newsletter, because we maybe receive a lot of them and we're not opening many. It's easy to use that self-reference criteria and think maybe it won't work. But very often you can get away with doing more.
We're not our audience.
Yeah.
I think the other really interesting nuance or nugget there as well is just kind of on these, micro experimentations, where you're not trying to, do a giant split test to your list or something. You're just like, I wonder what happens if we add, a 20% more newsletter sends in a month. And sure enough, people continue to want to pay attention to it. So that makes a lot of sense, and it's not a heavy lift.
I wonder, Phil, we talk, it's easy to, I think, as on the marketing side, we can imagine all the extra things that marketers need to do. But is the same kind of on the sales side as well? Like now there's social prospecting, or they're expected to connect with people on LinkedIn in addition to calling them, in addition to visiting them. And like, have you seen that kind of Have you heard that from the sales team, kind of the inflation that's happened on their end as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think on both ends. So, you know, how many emails do they have to send before they get a response? I think that number goes up every time I look at it, right? And there's tools to help, but the more people use the tools, then the more you still have to send. So I think there's pressure on them that way. I think social media is another big one. So we're, you know, probably the same as a lot of other industrial companies. You know, we're skeptical and slow to ever enter the social media world, and our presence is still limited. But we are active on LinkedIn, and we do encourage our sales team to prospect there as well. And I think that all those little interruptions and drains on their resources definitely come into play here. I think the other side of it is educating their customers. So as buyers get younger, they're having to do more consultative sales, which takes longer, more teaching, teaching customers, you know, how do you even buy what we're selling? What do we need to know? What's important? All of that. So, certainly not minimizing it. There's definitely more work on the sales side too.
Has that led to you working with the sales team to get even a deeper understanding of what you sell? Like, is it, are they having to become experts at a level that they didn't previously need to understand?
I think so. So our target is often engineering types. You know, they're detail oriented, they're specific, the words mean something. In order to have a sales conversation and really get somewhere and build trust with those people, it's important that you understand what you're selling and what we're doing to their parts. And there's a ton of trust involved in heat treatment. They're shipping us, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of material that they've spent time and money on, and trusting that we do something that often has zero visual impact on the product. It's impossible to tell whether we've done our job or not without testing the parts or believing us. So I think in order to build the kind of relationship that you need to sell heat treatment specifically, You have to be able to walk the walk a little bit and have some of those nitty gritty conversations. There's also 100 ways that it can go sideways if, you know, the parts don't fit in the furnace or we can't load as many as we think we can. And those are details that are, you know, you have to know how big the parts are. You have to go touch the parts, feel them, look at them, think about our baskets and our furnaces. So there's a level of technical know-how there that certainly is more than selling software probably. Not to bash on the SaaS guys too much.
They can take it. As we talk about all of these changes and the kind of evolving roles on both sides and even the evolving buyers and evolving sellers, do you see the structure of it all changing in the next little while? Like, are you sitting there thinking, you know what, we're probably going to have to bring in, lean on technical experts that salespeople bring into these conversations, because pretty soon all of our salespeople are going to be too young and none of them will know anything about it before they start here. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you seeing kind of structural shifts on the horizon because of these pressures?
Well, so your example is interesting, because that's something that we've done always is we have a staff of metallurgists that we lean on for that stuff. So while I say that, you know, salespeople have to have some level of expertise, they're not metallurgists at the end of the day. Often there are people at our industry who have metallurgist salespeople for the double whammy. But that's what we do, is we bring in the experts when we need them. We bring in the guy that's going to run the parts. We bring in the metallurgist to make sure the recipe's good. And it is a team effort. And that feels a little bit inspired by, to go back to the SaaS example, the time where you get on the call with the one person that you scheduled it with, and they've got six engineers and three other people in there that you've never seen before to help explain what it is that you're trying to buy. In terms of other structural changes, I think a lot of it is just about speed. So speed of getting back to customer requests, speed of quotes, and minimizing customer service calls to the extent that's possible. So small business stuff, but I also, you know, run our kind of customer service portal product where people can check on their order status, and you know, decreasing the number of phone calls for where are my parts, when can I expect them, all that stuff, and making that self-service, I think, is probably where the future lies, just as people get stretched more thin doing their jobs.
It kind of pointed to I guess one of the good things too is that, you know, we can maybe thank SaaS for they in some ways trained people that as you buy some stuff, there may be some other folks join the conversation. Maybe there's going to be less pressure on the salesperson having to know everything anyway, if you're used to buying other things in a more team-based approach, I suppose. Does that make any sense, Jeff?
Absolutely.
Or maybe. I don't know. Maybe
not. No, I think it does.
Yeah. It's nice to give the SaaS people at least the odd win since we beat up on them all the time.
Yeah, it's true. Phil, as you look to the future of this deepening integration between yourself and your sales team, and obviously the, you know, the metallurgists and other professionals at Paulo, what do you see as the next stage of this for your organization?
So I think the next stage, the future. So thinking about planning for the future and strategy there, I think alignment is key, which is, you know, kind of a worn out word, but I think still a valuable one, because that's what it takes to get all those people to show up for all those calls, to get, you know, to get things to move through the processes quickly, is that level of alignment. And ensuring that, you know, the metallurgist whose job description says nothing about revenue, you know, it might say something about, you know, helping to support customer needs and troubleshooting problems, but like at the end of the day, they're, you know, they care about revenue because they work for the company, but they're not positioned in that way normally. But getting aligned behind a revenue goal and a target, and seeing their part in that, and I think a lot of it is about, I see opportunities for us in the future to better use technology to manage the handoffs between these groups of people. So as we go from sales to marketing, you know, that one's been beat to death and it's still not perfect. But as we go from sales to metallurgy and engineering, and from sales to operations and to, you know, accounting and credits and collections and, you know, all that stuff, right? How do we move a customer through with, like you said earlier, the least friction possible? To me seems like the way to go. And I think there's a chance that some of the responsibilities shift, but I don't have a crystal ball. So I don't know where those will all end up, but you know, it might make sense to move some of these responsibilities around, but in the pursuit of making it easier for the customer.
And Phil, I really look forward to seeing how that shakes out, because you know, an awful lot of manufacturers are looking at their customer journey and kind of, you're right, a lot of the focus on that has been kind of more on the early end. Like what happens is somebody moves from marketing to sales. But that you know, post-sale transitioning, as you get somebody from onboarding, you know, using your service or your product for the first time, through to being a regular customer, et cetera. That's a part of the customer journey that I know a lot of people are seeking to, or just kind of talking about. How do we optimize it? How do we give visibility to it and almost bring a more modern digital sensibility to that work? So I think that's going to be really cool to see how you all pull that off. Phil, thank you for joining us today. It's been wonderful to have you on the show.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. I had a good time, so thanks.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you very much, Phil.